Second case for the day, HK Systems versus Eaton Corporation. Mr. Stiegel. Where are you, Mr. Stiegel?
May it please the court, I'm Michael Stiegel and I represent the appellant HK Systems. There was a jury verdict in this case and an award of damages to HK Systems. The verdict was based on the plain language of the indemnity agreement that had been entered into by the parties in an asset purchase agreement, and the jury found that HK's losses resulted from A, acts of Eaton Kenway, B, omissions of Eaton Kenway, and importantly, C, the occurrence of a matter with respect to the IBP project relating to or arising out of the period prior to the closing. Almost a year later, under the guise of reconsidering summary judgment, the court sua sponde reformed the parties' agreement and redefined resulting from in a manner never advanced or preserved by either Eaton or the court. The court created straw men to knock down on its road to creating absurd results in two scenarios. We believe that those determinations were skewed and artificial, and not examples of harmonizing the indemnity agreement. The sole issue before this court should be whether, given the totality of the evidence, did HK present sufficient evidence from which a reasonable jury could find in its favor? The simple answer is that there was ample evidence.
Well, the problem I think you have is that I don't understand how anyone could be thought to have indemnified another company for something that was going to occur later, and that the other company would have an opportunity to reconsider. I mean, suppose I agreed to sell Judge Evans a very expensive set of golf clubs, and I went to Judge Ripple and I said, would you provide me with insurance in case Judge Evans should sue me for selling it for? And then Judge Ripple says yes, and I sell Judge Evans the golf clubs. It turns out I've substituted a cheap brand. He sues me, gets damages.
That'd be typical.
Sues me, gets damages. I say, fine, you want damages? You have all the damages you want, because Judge Ripple has insured me against the consequences of my breach of contract. Well, similarly here, once HK has this indemnity, when it's dealing with IBP, it can say, yeah, whatever you want, you know, damages, settlement, huge settlement, we don't care because we have our indemnitor.
I think that that's not what occurred here. I think that
it did, because HK, it had a bid, of course. I mean, it had the bid. Eaton had gotten a bid. But it was HK that signed the contract. And if it was really insured against the consequences of being sued for breach of contract, that meant it had no incentive to be careful in negotiating the contract. Why would any sane company agree to that?
IBP was the largest beef processor in the world.
I don't care whether it's the largest beef processor in the world or in the universe. I don't see what that has to do with anything. The point is, it would be extremely reckless to insure against a breach of contract, right? I mean, we have cases which say, no, insurance companies don't insure you against the consequences of your breach of contract because... Because that's a voluntary act. So similarly, your decision to sign this contract with IBP, that was a voluntary decision you made after you'd bought A. And if you're right about indemnity, you had no incentive to be careful when you were negotiating with IBP that you didn't make a promise you couldn't. I mean, you could imagine a case where IBP says to HK, well, you've promised us, 3,000 boxes a minute or something. We'd like you to promise 10,000. And HK says, well, pretty unlikely that we could actually do that, but who cares? We're insured against it if we're sued for breach of contract. That's really what you're arguing, that you could have done that. You could have made a completely reckless promise to IBP, right?
I can't agree with that set of facts. We had a strong interest in completing this project successfully. We had purchased.
Of course you did, but you didn't have a strong interest in avoiding being sued, because if you were sued, your position is Eaton would pick up the tab.
Of course we wanted to avoid being sued. The
lawsuit, but you didn't want to avoid as much as you would have if you'd had to pay the damages in the suit rather than having Eaton to backstop you.
The issue in the IBP case, what permeated the IBP case, was this misrepresentation of Eaton that 3197, the throughput rate, was a sustainable rate.
But
on
you're
the
not outbound. Suing Eaton for fraud, right? You're trying to enforce this contract.
But and the losses and flow from
right?
Eaton's representation.
Pardon? Excuse
yes.
me? You're trying to, yeah, but you could sue them for fraud if you wanted. You haven't done that.
We had the indemnity protect us. We had a
ah,
really
that's the
indemnity.
Question. Look, you had a choice. You could sue for fraud. You forget about the indemnity contract. You're suing for breach of contract. Then the question is this indemnity clause really intended to protect you against contracts you sign after you've bought EK and Eaton is out of the picture?
And I say absolutely. The parties
agree. Why would Eaton do that? I mean, that's the logic. I think this bothered Judge Edelman. The logic of it. You don't insure, a pig in a poke. You don't say, look, I'm insuring you for anything you do. You can be careless and be stupid. It's all right. I'm insuring you. That's how you read this indemnity agreement.
Eaton did it because we had less than a month of due diligence. It wouldn't open its books to
us. I don't understand what that has to do with anything.
Well, that was the reason.
If they won't, if you suspect that they're not leveling with you, they're rushing you and so on, fine. You don't have to buy EK. You can say I'm not going to sign it without special protections. But I don't think these indemnity agreements can be construed as insuring the indemnity against acts that he does after the sale, after the indemnitor has lost all control over the transaction.
Our position was that we complied with the contract. We lived up to the construction agreement. What permeated?
I know, but then you're sued because the other side doesn't agree, and apparently there's some merit to their suit, which means it was improvident for you to sign the contract. You guaranteed a performance that you couldn't achieve.
We restricted the performance.
Yeah,
we
but
said that all
you were sued, right? You were sued.
We couldn't prevent being sued.
Of course not.
IBP could
yes, you could have prevented being sued by not signing the contract. You weren't obligated to sign a contract with IBP.
It was the intended result of why we bought Eaton Kenway, was to buy these different projects, which were defined as contracts in the asset purchase agreement. Everybody contemplated the foreseeability of the situation was that we were going to contract with IBP. And our position was below that a contract by Eaton Kenway was irrelevant. The losses had to result from Eaton Kenway's acts or omission. We didn't ask the jury to indemnify us for any fault of our own. We were very careful that we only wanted indemnity from Eaton Kenway's acts, omissions, and the occurrence of a matter that related back to prior to the closing. That was what the parties agreed to. That's the efficiency of the contract. That was the allocation of the risk here. And now Judge Adelman has decided to rewrite the parties' agreement.
I don't know that that's fair to Judge Adelman. He made a decision initially, and upon reflection, he decided I was dead wrong, and he reversed himself, which... And sometimes we grant rehearings after panel decisions are released, and I don't know that that's something to be critical of the judge for.
Under the facts and circumstances of this case, I don't believe that Judge Adelman could create a new standard post-jury trial that we never had a chance to meet.
A new standard? It's not a new standard. It's, look, a judge can take a case away from a jury because he thinks that as a matter of law, one of the parties should win and the other lose. That's perfectly proper.
But he didn't do that. He didn't grant a Rule 50 motion. He decided to reconsider summary judgment and went off on his own.
But the standard for summary judgment is the same as the standard for a judgment as a matter of...
Yes.
And what does it matter whether he said, I'm going to grant judgment as a matter of law, or I'm going to grant summary judgment?
Because Rule 50 wouldn't have allowed him to do it because the issue wasn't preserved. Eaton never objected to resulting from, and we tried to define resulting from. They stood mute. There was never a specific objection to the causation element of the instructions or of the contract. Eaton never advanced what Judge Adelman decided was how this thing should be construed. We never had a chance to try that issue. This all occurred post hoc.
Well, are you saying that Eaton could not have appealed on the ground that it was entitled to judgment as a matter of law?
I recognize the Rickey case, and I'm saying that
you're saying that it could
yes,
not
under
have
Watson,
appealed?
The issue was not preserved. And under Rickey, I read Rickey as being solely a question of law, the res judicata issue. And here it was a mixed question of fact.
No, wait. Forget mixed question of fact and law. Could Eaton have appealed to us and said that no reasonable interpretation of this contract could justify the jury verdict, and there's no need for extrinsic evidence. The agreement is clear. It doesn't protect against.
No.
Is that barred to them, that argument?
Yes.
That has nothing to do with a mixture of fact and law. That's just saying on the face of the contract, no case.
I'm saying
they can't say that. They couldn't appeal to.
They could not have appealed the issue.
Why did you mention mixed question of fact and law?
Because that's how I read your.
But
exception you created.
No. Suppose that, I mean, most contract cases are decided just on the contract. So are you saying Eaton couldn't argue to us that this indemnity agreement does not protect against, you know, subsequent conduct subsequent to the sale by Eaton? They would be barred from arguing that? Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is that the issue was not preserved for appeal once there was a jury trial. What I'm saying is that Eaton never argued the holding or the basis for Judge Adelman's ruling. Eaton argued legal liability. Judge Adelman rejected that over and over.
Wait. Argued legal liability, what does that mean?
They argued that they had to be legally liable under resulting from, and the judge rejected that over and over. They argued that unless there was a contract, they couldn't be liable. The judge rejected that over and over again, and he created a new standard that it had to arise out of Eaton's conduct. The claim had to arise out of Eaton's conduct. We could have argued that to the jury. We never got the chance to do that. And arise out of Eaton, claims
well,
arise
out of Eaton. What's the difference in arise and result from?
Well, I think there is a difference because.
Oh, come on. That's just semantic.
We never argued but for liability.
There's no difference between arise out of and result from. Where do you get that difference from?
I get the difference in the quality of what we're
arguing. Oh, come on. Those are just meaningless words. Arise from, result from, caused by, not anything.
We tried to define resulting from using the definition that the court had held. Judge, let me just finish by saying that why did IBP pursue a sustainable rate of 31.97? Not because of anything that HK ever did. HK tried to restrict it, and it didn't happen. That's what the contract said. And we complied with that contract.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Stiegel. Mr. King?
Mr. Stiegel, may it please the court. I'd like to just address a couple of points. One is, we argued causation and legal liability right from the start. That's what this case was about right from the start. As a matter of fact, there needs to be a contract notion is a little misguided. There was preliminary negotiation on a contract. This was a contract that was going to be involving almost $15 million, $14 million and some change, involving construction of highly complex systems over a period of years. The ultimate proof of the contract that existed was that the final proposal that HK made after they had completed the purchase of Kenway was almost 600 pages long, including the purchase orders, the draft purchase orders, the specifications, the contract itself. So this was not something that was being done on the back of an envelope. This was a highly complex project. There were, at the time of the completion of the sale of the business to HK, several open issues on that contract that were not resolved. There was not a situation where, even on a best-case scenario from HK's perspective, either HK or IBP could have simply said, I accept the proposal that's on the table and signed it. There was a lot of negotiation still to be done. The ultimate proof, incidentally, in the answer to the question that you asked Mr. Stiegel about what incentive HK would have to avoid a lawsuit, in the theory that they've adopted, is demonstrated by the facts of this case. They walked off this job in a dispute with IBP. Had they had the recognition that they were responsible for their performance of the contract, and there's no question, there's no argument that we interfered with that contract, there's no argument that we could have done anything to ensure the successful performance of that contract, we were not there. We had no personnel there. We had no ability to influence the outcome. Nor did we have any ability to influence what the final contract looked like. That was purely a question of the negotiation between HK and IBP. You'll also recall that with respect to that negotiation, the total structure of that contract changed. When we were negotiating the contract prior to the sale of the business, it had been set up as essentially a joint venture. So ALBI would have a separate contract with IBP for its part of the project, and we would have an integration contract for our part of it. HK changed that around so that Alvey would be a subcontractor of theirs. They would get more money, but they also took responsibility then for the performance of Alvey and the supervision of Alvey in the performance of the contract. Issues that we had absolutely nothing to do with that were strictly theirs. They argued consistently to the district court that there was some pre-existing contract, that there was some obligation that they had been stuck with, as they called it at trial, a doomed project. Now, the point that we made with respect to contracts, just so we're clear, the damages asserted here were breach of contract damages asserted against HK by IBP for the non-performance, for breaches of the warranties, and various other issues relating to the contract. They sued on a specific contract, the March 23 contract, a contract to which we were not a party. You can't be held liable for a breach of a contract that you're not a party to, unless, you know, it's on some kind of tortious interference ground, which doesn't exist here. We couldn't have guaranteed that. There was nothing that we had to do with that contract. We were long gone. As a matter of fact, the argument that they made consistently before the district court and before the jury, part of which led to, I think, the district court's confusion about what the situation was they argued this notion that there was a pre-existing obligation when they acquired the company and that they had no choice. I mean, that's just nonsense. It's just absolutely nonsense. They also argued, and they argued to you, incidentally, that they were bound to close the asset purchase agreement. And they point that out in their brief that I asked a question at the trial. If you look at the asset purchase agreement, just as a matter of law, that's also nonsense. Article 5 makes clear the representations and warranties, and it relieves the purchaser of an obligation to close if there's a material deviation. The typical standard language that you see in contracts. That's in Article 5. There's also an adjustment to purchase price under 2.8. They've also argued to you, and it's part of this notion that there's pre-existing obligation, which, as a matter of law, is just not sustainable as a proposition.
I ask you just one thing here. I'm trying to figure out when the suit was this in Nebraska or something, the lawsuit.
Yes, sir.
Settled in 01.
Yes, sir.
For quite a bit of money. Was Eaton ever invited to participate in the settlement negotiations?
Let me explain that.
An opinion as to the reasonableness of that amount of money? Because if as Judge Posner's questions brought out, I think this case was settled for $14 million or $9 million or $100 million. It wouldn't make any difference to HK if you had to foot the bill.
We were not invited to participate. What we were asked for, just so the record is clear, because this has been one of the misconceptions, they've said that they tendered the defense, and Judge Edelman, I think, got a little confused on this notion of tendering the defense. The defense was never tendered to Eaton, and Eaton never had a duty to defend, which makes it, of course, different from the Dominski case. They had an option to defend, but they never had a duty. So the tender, there was never
why
a tender.
Why did they even have an option to defend? They were not at all involved in this new contract.
That's why they turned it down.
Contract.
That's why they turned it down, because they weren't involved. They had nothing to do with anything. You know, the truth is that what happened here, they took over the negotiations. Obviously, they got into a contentious relationship with the customer IBP. You can see that in the negligent misrepresentation count, where they demanded another $870,000 and promised that they'd finish the job according to the allegations, and then got the money and then walked off the job. So there was a lot of bad feeling. The fact that IBP may have thrown the kitchen sink into allegations doesn't change the fact that there was no legally recognizable claim or act or omission by Eaton that gave rise to any damages. Because preliminary negotiations, as they argued to the court in Nebraska correctly, HK did, and prevailed on, should have been the end of this case, frankly. And we asked Judge Edelman to throw this case out right at the beginning, saying the Nebraska court has ruled on the motion of HK that there was absolutely no obligation to complete a deal. They could have walked away. There was no pre-existing obligation. They concluded a separate negotiation, both parties. Both parties signed a contract that had nothing to do with Eaton. And any previous conversation that had occurred was barred by either the parallel evidence rule or was a sales pitch and without legal consequence. That's the position that they argued to the Nebraska court, quite correctly. There was an integration clause in their contract. There was an integration clause in all of these contracts. These are, you know, these were large companies doing, you know, the appropriate kind of language drafting in these documents. And the Nebraska court agreed with them. And then they turned around and they went to Judge Edelman and they said in the complaint that the letter of intent, the two-line letter of intent, was a contract. That's in paragraph 9. And then they said in the amended contract in paragraph 18 that there was, you know, first you have 9, so they said there's a contract prior to the time that they buy the company. And then they say in paragraph 18 that there is this first amended contract, which is the one that signed on March 23. The truth is, there's only one contract. That's the March 23 contract, separately negotiated, separately signed. They got all the money. They did all the work. Eaton never hammered a nail or turned a screw, had no capacity to ensure that this contract was adequately performed, had no influence over the terms of the contract. Eaton's role was long gone. There were clearly preliminary negotiations, and there was preliminary work in trying to establish what it would look like. The other thing that Mr. Stiegler said was that under the contract sections of the asset purchase agreement, the schedules, and he cites in his papers to section 7.1. If you look at 7.1, I don't want to belabor it because it's clear there was no contract, but just to dot the I's and cross the T's. If you look at 7.1 and you look at the definitions that generate 7.1, that's under section 2.2 of the same document. And if you look at the last clause at the bottom of 2.2, it talks about the things that are going to be listed on that section at 7.10 on the schedule includes contracts that may be signed that will require a third-party contract. So it talks about future events. It's not talking about any list of existing contracts. And if you look at their due diligence material and their internal stuff, they say there's no contract. And in fact, they say to IBP, they threaten IBP that if they don't get rid of the consequential and incidental damages clause in the drafted documents, you know, they won't sign the contract. So they know there's no contract. They know there's no pre-existing relationship. So the district court was, I think, frankly misled, and that's what created this issue. It's also clear that the district court said in his opinion that he considered no new legal arguments, and he took no facts from the trial. He looked at the causation issue, which had been briefed time and time and time and time again, and he finally got it. And he understood, he misapprehended before. That's perfectly clear from the trial transcript when he says nobody's argued about causation before, and that was just wrong. So he didn't understand what we were saying. He didn't understand the contract argument that, you know, we were saying that because these are contract damages, you either have to be a party to the contract to be liable, or you have to have, you know, something else that created liability, because liability flows not from the allegation. Liability flows from an act or omission by us that resulted in a loss.
Well, and they argue that you misrepresented the capacity of this box conveyor belt, whatever it was, and that's what caused them to lose their case or settle the case with BAP.
And that's just nonsense. what we said in the initial draft, one of the things that was discussed was that we would meet or exceed this 3,197 boxes per hour. That language was changed by negotiation between HK and IBP. And so that the language that wound up in the document itself, in the contract, the March 23 contract, was not to exceed or maximum. I can't remember what it was. I guess it was maximum.
I thought it was that it was whether it would meet this number under certain conditions
right,
or all conditions.
That was fundamentally, that's the dispute that led to the blow-up of the relationship between IBP and HK. Again, it had nothing to do with us. They had to define, the system was going to be accepted on appropriate simulation testing that would prove that the system worked. And the dispute that they wound up with was a dispute between whether, as IBP wanted, it would meet those standards under all circumstances, all conditions, or the way HK wanted, in, I guess, ideal circumstances. But again, a dispute that we were not a part of, had no influence on, couldn't have impacted the outcome, had nothing to do with. But there was never the fact that IBP, in a dispute with these guys, later says, you know, from the start we had this long letter, is legally irrelevant. The court in Nebraska found it was irrelevant. It had nothing to do, it couldn't have created any liability or loss. Because somebody says something in a lawsuit that is irrelevant and is stricken and doesn't form the basis of a liability, it can't create a loss. It has no legal consequence, and that was the point. So the long letter is irrelevant in these instances. And in any event, it's negotiated out. They're not bound by it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. King.
Thank you very much, Aaron.
Mr. Stiegel, it's time to see you now. There's no time. His time ran out? Well, we'll give you a minute, Mr. Stiegel.
Thank you. HK is indemnified for risks it couldn't control. And that's what happened.
But, of course, it could control just by not signing the contract with IBP.
The contract incorporated the letter of intent.
Do you think that HK was contractually obligated to sign that contract with IBP?
I think they were.
Really?
Yes. I think that IBP made an order, and everybody agreed to it.
Now, wait. You think Eaton had a contract with IBP that was assigned to HK? Is that your argument?
There was no assignment.
Is that your argument? Well, it had to be.
We argued that...
Look, is it your argument that Eaton had a contractual obligation to IBP, which HK then succeeded to?
We said a contract
answer
was
my question. Answer my question.
Yes.
Answer my question.
Yes.
That's a new one. I didn't realize you were.
No, we argued that the contract, whether there was a contract or not.
Well, wait a second. That makes a big difference. I thought what you just said, which surprised me, but
no,
maybe.
We argued that the
Let
letter...
me finish.
Okay.
I understood you just to say that Eaton actually had a contract with IBP, and that when it sold, you renamed EK to you, that contract bound HK.
Yes.
So HK had to go ahead with BHP. That's
yes.
What you're arguing?
Yes. We said that a contract was irrelevant, but if Eaton required a contract, there was a contract. Under Wisconsin law, the letter of intent is construed by, not in a vacuum, and based on what the parties thought, and we introduced evidence as to what the parties thought. Alvey said it was an order. Alvey's attorneys threatened us with interference.
So the jury found that there was a contract between Eaton and IBP?
I don't know that the jury found there was a contract or not. I know.
But you're arguing there is.
I argued that there was a contract, yes, Your Honor. And, in fact, the court said at one point that whether there was a contract or not was a question of fact. We couldn't control what we didn't know about, Judge. And we didn't know about this 3197 sustainable rate that was guaranteed 4 days after the due diligence. And as for changing the relationships of the party, Exhibit 12 at the trial showed that IBP wanted one contract, one responsible party. And if the court will look at the construction contract, specifically Section 1.2, it incorporates the letter of intent as part of the contract. Eaton introduced evidence that the construction agreement was a final contract. And we argued that that meant that there was a preliminary contract or an interim contract. The jury decided all these issues.
Well, no, you just said the jury didn't make a finding about whether it was a...
They decided that our losses resulted from
Eaton's
acts.
But you just said the jury decided all these issues, and yet a minute ago you said they didn't decide whether Eaton had a contract.
I said I didn't know if they decided. I don't know what was in the jury's mind. I know that we argued contract. We argued it was irrelevant, but if Eaton insisted and the court found there should be a contract, there was a contract. And we argued that over and over again.
Okay.
Take a look at the closing argument.
Okay.
The,
okay. Thank you, Mr. Steger.
One more point, Your Honor.
Okay.
The truth is that we couldn't finish the job. And the reason we couldn't finish the job is we couldn't make a 3197 sustainable rate that we didn't know about until the end of the deal. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel. Next case.